Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
The most important shift in mindset that we're trying to bring about is moving from a passive acceptance of the effects of technology to a recognition that the effects of technology on society are in our control. But that doesn't mean that they are only in our control via the actions of elected officials. They're in our control because all of us engage with technology in a variety of ways. Some of us design and build technology. Some of us work in the businesses that invest in technology. Most, if not all of us, are users of technology. And then, of course, all of us are citizens who influence the way that our politics shapes technology. So there's a role for all of us in affecting this debate, and we can't reduce what's required to will Congress act.
Good morning, everyone. I hope everyone is having a great start to the day. I'm recording this on Wednesday night, but I will tell you that as you are listening to this right now, I am preparing slash taping my first ever guest hosting appearance on Breaking Points. I'm filling in for Crystal. I'm going to be doing that today and then this upcoming Tuesday. I'm incredibly excited. So as soon as you finish listening to this episode, be sure to go over Breaking Points and see how Sagar and I actually play off each other in a totally different format. I've hosted once before. That was way, way, way earlier in my media career. It was actually right before COVID. So hopefully I've improved somewhat by then, but super excited. Definitely go check it out. Secondly, this episode is going to be a solo one with me. I recorded this when Sagar was out of commission during his COVID kerfuffle slash scare. It's a really great conversation. I've brought on the authors of System Error, Where Big Tech Went Wrong and How We Can Reboot. This book is available for pre-order and it is out this upcoming Tuesday, September 7th. I have two of the authors, Mehran Sahami and Jeremy Weinstein. They are actually Stanford professors. This is basically culminating this higher ed focused week that we have here with the start of the school year coming upon us. The basic idea for this show is everyone here knows I'm really obsessed with big tech, but I'm incredibly frustrated by people's inability to bring clear thinking, good faith arguments, and even just useful frameworks to how they confront these issues, whether or not they're content moderation, the size of the companies themselves, how founders should run the company, how media should actually cover the companies themselves. So this is a great episode for bringing two professors who focused incredibly deeply on coming up with frameworks and answers that people are going to think about. Another great example of what we're trying to build here at The Realignment, where the idea here is, look, no matter how you think about these issues, let's at least come together and try to think about them in a useful way so that we can actually move forward. The real focus of this episode is the idea that we have the ability as citizens, as users, as founders, as designers to actually take the various decisions that we're putting in front of you to actually do something with them. It's pretty easy to get cynical. I think there's nothing we could do about things, but Professors Sahami and Weinstein are really good at pushing back on the bit that I brought there. But it's always refreshing to think about these things from a different angle, even if we disagree. So, of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting the work of this podcast. And a final reminder, go check out Breaking Points today. Hope we do a great job for all of you. Let's dive into the episode. Mehran, Jeremy, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks very much for hosting.
What I really appreciated about System Error is the fact that you all are taking this approach to these big questions about the future of the technology industry and the US from the perspective of there are all these open questions and we as a society are attempting to figure out what exactly we should answer those questions with and how we should actually think about the questions themselves. So I want to take this episode in a really straightforward manner. You all teach at Stanford, so I'm going to pretend I could have gotten into Stanford after high school, and I will ask you questions that are just going to come to mind immediately after all of this. The first one of which is, at the start of the book, you make clear that for the past 10 years or so, we've seesawed between tech optimism. It's 2011, software is eating the world, Google Glass is coming down the line. Everyone, including you, Jeremy, I'm sure you'll talk about this, is going into the Obama administration because the tech industry has something to teach the US government. That's really the tech optimism piece. We then, obviously, for a variety of complicated reasons that we'll get into during this show, shift to the more, as you put it, dystopian perspective on the tech industry. A lot of this is going to tie into the election of President Trump in 2016, debates about Facebook. Then there's this broader conversation around phone addiction and privacy, all those different bits. But you two are positing that we are trying to move beyond these two extremes towards a more nuanced position. So a great way to start, I'll throw this to you first, Mehran, is how do you really think of us as a country? Like, where are we in terms of our relationship with the tech industry if we're not dystopian and if we're not purely just overly optimistic?
That's a great question. You know, I think the place that we're at is we're a place where we appreciate the affordances and the benefits that technology gives us. But at the same time, we have a trepidation about what are we giving up in order to engage with that technology? Are we giving up our privacy? What's going to happen down the line as technology incorporates more aspects of our lives, right? When we have AI potentially displacing jobs, when algorithms are making decisions about things that are meaningful to us in our life. And in many cases, they already do. They do things like screen resumes for jobs. They determine who gets access for credit. So while we see the tremendous benefits of technology, we also have this unease about what does it mean for our lives? How is it going to affect us? And what we'd really like to have is a mature and sober conversation about what do these things mean? What are the safeguards that we'd like to see put in place through regulation and through the companies themselves? What are the ways that we think about the evolution of this landscape that we, where we can still draw on the benefits we get from these technologies while avoiding some of the harms that we've seen in the past few years? And that's why we get pulled in the directions of these poles, right? When the technology first becomes available to us, we begin to see the power that it gives us when we can do things like now we have our phones and we're connected all the time. But then when we hear about scandals like Cambridge Analytica, suddenly it's a wake-up call to say, look, there's other things that are happening with the data that's being collected. There's things that we feel like we don't have control of, and this is a moment for us to be able to reassert that control.
If I can add one thing, Marshall, there's another way of thinking about the moment that we're at, which is, you know, the first moment of the internet was one in which what happened with technology was really entirely in the hands of these brilliant and inventive coders. We thought of them as the hackers back then, and people were inspired by the potential, amazed by the products that were generated. Then we entered a second moment where the hackers were instrumentalized by the financiers, right? And ultimately, you got the emergence of big companies that took these inventive ideas and scaled them to billions of people. And at that moment, the power shifted not just from the technologists who were building technology, but to the CEOs that were running these companies and ultimately the venture capitalists and investors that were behind them. The consequence of the backlash is that we're now entering a third moment where as citizens or as politicians or as users of technology, we've lost our faith in the guidance of the technologists or the companies on their own. And you're now finding yourself in a moment where the rules that govern technology are going to be the result of a push and pull among those people who create products and build companies and users that push back on concerns that they have, and then citizens and the officials who elect us who look to impose constraints on the industry, in particular to mitigate some of the harms that we've seen. Harms, whether it's the loss of jobs, the erosion of privacy, you know, the misinformation that pollutes our information ecosystem. These are all harms that are going to demand a democratic response, but ultimately politicians won't be able to do it on their own. So it's going to be a push and pull, a give and take, as we figure out what it means for democracy to govern technology.
I really, really like the framing of citizens, politicians, users. I would just add the actual founders or the folks who are running the companies themselves to this framework as we're talking about this, because I'm really interested in your point that ultimately a lot of these decisions are going to be subject to democratic feedback. And I know that, once again, towards the start of the book, you all very clearly are positing that folks should not just say, hey, I don't have the ability to put input into this. My perspective isn't going to matter. But it actually seems like, speaking to the idea of what this show is actually about, we are in one of those moments where it doesn't seem like the country actually can come to a democratic consensus on much of these issues. A good way of thinking about this, and I'll throw this back to you, Jeremy, so we can keep this thing going, is if you actually look at the rhetoric around content moderation, if you look at Senator Amy Klobuchar, I have her book right behind me, in her book Antitrust, her case against Facebook is very tied to this idea that Facebook enables misinformation, disinformation, the way you're talking about here. But if you talk to Senator Josh Hawley, who we've had on the show as well too, he would say, actually, Facebook censors too much and Facebook actually isn't a fair platform. These positions are often caricatured as there's this big bipartisan coalition going against big tech, but obviously these are two contradictory positions. So how, in this moment of real discord, should we think of how a society can actually come to a real consensus on these topics?
It's a fabulous question, Marshall. And let me start by saying that the most important shift in mindset that we're trying to bring about is moving from a passive acceptance of the effects of technology to a recognition that the effects of technology on society are in our control. But that doesn't mean that they are only in our control via the actions of elected officials. They're in our control because all of us engage with technology in a variety of ways. Some of us design and build technology. Some of us work in the businesses that invest in technology. Most, if not all of us, are users of technology. And then, of course, all of us are citizens who influence the way that our politics shapes technology. So there's a role for all of us in affecting this debate. And we can't reduce what's required to will Congress act? Because as you rightly noted, will Congress act is not just a question of whether we can agree on what the problem is and the way forward, but it's a function of polarization. It's a function of the battles between the parties. It's a function of some profound disagreements that exist in our politics about the role of government and the role of the private sector. That said, there is an important role for politics. And I think one of the key arguments that we make in the book is that the framework to bring to democracy is that democracy is our technology for resolving different values and trade-offs that we confront as a society. And for folks who are uncomfortable with content moderation, the power that's invested in Zuck's hands or Jack Dorsey's hands, what we need is more public-facing, transparent, and democratic mechanisms that ensure that these important and consequential decisions aren't made by a small group of unaccountable individuals operating behind the scenes. Now, our perspective on democracy, though, is that these are hard issues. And of course, part of what democracy, one of the reasons it exists is that we can't always come to agreement. So we need to talk to one another. We need to deliberate and debate. We need to kind of work toward an agreement about what problems we want to solve and what the way forward is. And what you see right now in Washington at this moment is tremendous concern about lots of different aspects of technology. As you indicated with Klobuchar and Hawley, different views about the nature of the problem and the potential solution. And we think the most important first step is to find that set of issues where there's a common concern about the nature of the problem and the solution. And so good examples of what fits in that space, greater privacy protection. We already see Europe acting on this. We already see California taking a leadership role. This is something where there's broad agreement on what the problem is. Greater data portability for citizens so that they can move between platforms to create space for competition. Greater oversight and accountability for the use of algorithmic decision-making systems. These are issues where, setting aside antitrust and sort of misinformation and content moderation, these are problems where the harms are visible, longstanding, broad agreement, and we can take meaningful steps forward. That doesn't mean we shouldn't go after issues of antitrust, that we shouldn't go after issues of content moderation, and we talk about how we think about those issues in the book. But we have to show that our democratic institutions can make progress on some of the most evident harms and do it in a bipartisan way. And we as citizens need to hold our politicians accountable for doing so.
How about you, Mehran?
The thing I would add there is, you know, if you look at something like the Facebook Oversight Board, right, the Facebook Supreme Court, so to speak, you know, they speak to this point where when they took up the issue of Donald Trump being deplatformed, you know, they took up that case. And what they did was they came back in spring of this year and they said, you know, for the time being, we're upholding the ban. But really what we're giving is Facebook 6 months to revisit the case and provide some clear public standards for continuing the ban, right? So what they were looking for there is what are the guidelines by which someone gets banned? Now, ultimately, we don't feel that should be Facebook's decision, right? Those guidelines for whether or not someone gets banned from a platform are something that should be a matter of debate and this push and pull that Jeremy talked about to eventually reach a set of guidelines that societally we have some consensus around. And so that's part of the point is that what we're beginning to see now is more publicly these decisions that have been made by a small group of people moving into a discourse in the public sphere that we need the guidelines there. And the question is, how do we get them? Do we just leave them in the hands of a few executives at companies, or do we make them a matter of public discourse? It's a hard problem, but if we don't make it a matter of public discourse, then we've basically abdicated our ability to do anything about it.
I'm going to be a bit of a contrarian here and just push back on the idea that we shouldn't just leave this up to executives at companies that they run. Because, I mean, look, my problem with the argument around leaving these debates up to democracy in the political process is that it assumes a degree of actual good faith in that process. So, for example, we're recording this on the 26th. We've had multiple Republican senators declare that Joe Biden should resign over what's happening in Afghanistan right now. You have Lindsey Graham saying we should explore impeachment when a lot of these same folks after January 6th, which you guys actually start the book off with, were claiming that Donald Trump was hunky-dory, everything's totally fine. Because the secret here is that everyone involved in this process, regardless of your perspective, is politically ambitious and has their own actual desires. So I just have a problem with the implications that we should leave things up to the public when the public doesn't actually have an effective good faith process of actually coming to a consensus position. So I'm just curious what your response to that is.
I guess I'd say two things, Marshall. First, you know, let me be 100% clear that we don't think this problem can be solved by our politics alone, right? So major parts of the book are about what it means to cultivate an ethic of responsibility among technologists, how you generate that in the process of training technologists, how you institutionalize that in the structure of companies. And so we need to build out a transformation in the private sector as well with respect to these issues. But that said, you know, I will tangle with you any day on sort of experts versus our democracy or company elites versus our democracy when it comes to the question of how we're going to referee the most essential value trade-offs that our society needs to grapple with. It is 100% clear what the bottom line of these companies are. It is clear what they are optimizing for. And what they are optimizing for are a set of profit-related motives that don't take into account things that I care about: justice, fairness, equality of opportunity, right? A healthy space for democratic deliberation and debate. The opportunity for people to be able to have access to meaningful work and put food on the table. These are not things that company leaders are optimizing for. And so we need a counterbalance to that. And if you feel the same concern about the health of our democracy that I do, and believe me, I feel it deeply, we feel it not only with respect to the governing of technology, but also with respect to dealing with climate change, right? Or dealing with other major existential threats to the future of the United States. What that leads me to do is redouble my investment in our democratic politics, and also to think not only about what happens at the national level, where we see this polarization on display, but also how we use our state legislatures, right? And one of the great things about California, which is where we're based, is that California has decided to step in and grapple with many of these issues of regulating tech, following the lead of the European Union, because California sees the dysfunction that's happening in Washington and says, we're going to address these evident harms and we're not going to wait for Washington to lead.
The thing I would add to that is, you know, I spent the better part of a decade at Google and, you know many of the people there and leaders of the company, and they're well-intentioned, well-meaning people. But even if you have well-intentioned, well-meaning people running a company, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the values from that company, the things that you would want more broadly societally. The other way I think about it is, you know, let's say that they happen to come up with a set of guidelines which actually are great guidelines and they're self-regulating. Why wouldn't we want to adopt that self-regulation as a form of real regulation and turn it into laws? And the reason why we would want to do that is because if there's a change of leadership at the company where there's new entrants into the space who decide that they want to craft these kinds of issues around privacy or around misinformation in a different way, then we don't get the outcomes we actually care about. So really what we want to get to a place is to say, yes, companies certainly play a role. The technologists play a role, the executives play a role, and the politicians play a role, because we need to find a set of solutions that work for everyone and then codify those solutions to make sure that we can level the playing field, that everyone's playing by the same rules.
So let's go back to the framework around citizens, politicians, users, because once again, I really appreciate it. I think it's a really useful one. Trump comes to office in 2017. Very quickly, he is definitely violating the spirit, if not the law, of the terms of service in a bunch of different platforms. But once again, he is the president of the United States, the somewhat titular leader of the free world. So the companies themselves are in a difficult position here. Your class is actually really structured around helping technologists think through these situations. There isn't any world where, especially after the 2018 midterms, Congress would come to any sort of consensus around here is what the rules and regulations around a head of state when it comes to a Twitter service or any type of place like YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how would you advise your students to think through that dilemma there? AKA, we all know there's a part of those technologists who I'm sure would like Congress to take that up, but that isn't going to happen. So what do you do during this 2017 to 2021 period where there isn't going to be that public decision? How should you advise technologists in good faith think of the deplatforming question when it comes to a head of state?
So one of our colleagues at Stanford, Rene D'Aresta, distinguishes freedom of speech from freedom of reach, something that we talk about in the book. And while we robustly come down in defense of freedom of speech, what the platforms provide to people is an ability to take their message and amplify it in ways that was never possible in the absence of these social media platforms. And so I think you're right, in the aftermath of 2016 or the 2018 midterms, you're not going to get congressional agreement on what a set of oversight standards should look like for content moderation. What you're relying on that point is a set of decisions by companies and the technologists who work for those companies and the financiers behind those companies about how they approach content moderation. And we think, especially as we train young technologists, that it is entirely appropriate for young technologists and for founders of companies to be thinking not only about their bottom line when it comes to profit or the clickbait that keeps people on their platform, but also to take a value like the health of democratic deliberation in the United States, the health of our information ecosystem, and value it, and to think about how those values should shape your decisions about what content gets promoted, what ends up where in the newsfeed, the extent to which you attach warning labels to incorrect or misleading content, and when you make decisions about taking content down. And what we saw with the creation of the Facebook Oversight Board was very much Facebook's recognition that there's not a ton of legitimacy that they have to make these decisions on their own. And so they're wanting to open up their process to broader deliberation and debate. And that's really in the spirit of where regulation is likely to take us, right? Not removing the ability of companies competing with one another to create different information ecosystems that are available to you and me, depending on our preferences. But that in a society that is governed democratically, we need visibility about what those policies are. We need transparency about how those decisions are made. We need the ability to seek recourse in the event that we want to challenge those decisions. And that's exactly the direction that we're beginning to move. What has been most challenging is lacking that transparency and feeling that ultimately these companies are making decisions behind a wall, right? With their own priorities, not subject to any sort of conversation, neither with their user base or more broadly. And of course, we've seen the consequences of that, right? Acting too late, acting not at all. And ultimately, now we've got all of the evidence that we need to suggest that content moderation is one of the most important responsibilities that companies confront, not just when it came to electioneering, but also when we think about COVID misinformation. And the work that we've seen unfolding on COVID misinformation shows that one of the powers of the platform is to detect very quickly who is promoting COVID misinformation, how relatively a small number of people it is, and to think about how they use their tools to correct that misinformation, to slow down the spread of it. And that can be very powerful if we think about the values that we have as a democratic society.
I would add that there's, you know, two levels, I think, of grappling with these issues. One is when companies are trying to make these kinds of decisions, for example, about who has access to speech, how does it get amplified? You know, to the original question you asked, one of the things to grapple with is why should a head of state have more freedom of speech than any other individual in that society? Right. If a platform wants to take that view, as Jeremy mentioned, there needs to be transparency as to why. There needs to be a set of rules and guidelines that explain what is really different about a head of state or some other person, perhaps a celebrity, as to why they get different speech rules than an individual. If at a fundamental level, we don't believe that should be the case, then that needs to be something that needs to be codified and specified so that platforms don't just take different kind of willy-nilly approaches to how speech is treated and who gets it. The second one on the transparency point is to take what Jeremy said, you know, even one step further. We certainly need transparency to understand what's going on, the decision-making in the companies. But at a broad level, much of the decision-making that happens around content moderation is algorithmic because the scales are just too great for human beings to have to go through all this stuff. Although there are large armies of thousands of content moderators that look at this information. And so part of that transparency is both understanding what are the rules internally in the company for the human moderators, but also understanding what's happening at scale with automatic or automated moderating that's happening in these algorithms. That gets a little touchy because you don't want to give too much away, because if you do, then it allows the people who are trying to disseminate the misinformation to work around your algorithms. But it's also not appropriate for them to be entirely opaque and just the companies to say, well, we're making our best effort, trust us.
I have to be an audience advocate here and just echo the thoughts that folks have around disinformation and misinformation, especially in the COVID. And I'm not asking these in a gotcha sense, because I really appreciate the frameworks they all are bringing here. There are various points that the Wuhan lab leak theory was labeled disinformation and misinformation. That is no longer true. That is something that can be talked about on a social platform. The Hunter Biden story at the New York Post, that is, I think, a situation where, to your point, Mehran, around platforms not being transparent, not having a policy, it leads to making snap judgments that everyone regrets after the fact. But I think the broader point I'm making is that there are these very direct examples, obviously, especially when it comes to COVID cures, where I think there's a lot of very clear examples of like real harms. But there are these other cases where things that were thought of as misinformation and disinformation are no longer considered so. So how should founders, once again, politicians and citizens and even users at this level, how should they think about how humble or like our epistemic humility when it comes to how much we can and can't know? Because if you look at Mark Zuckerberg's defenses, and once again, he's usually between a rock and a hard place, but when you look at his more forward-facing defenses, he's saying something like, look, I don't know, so I'm not going to make a judgment on it. And that tends to piss off people to the center left and to the left. So how should we think about those questions of humility in the COVID context? Especially when I'll throw in the one last example. Sorry, I'm hearing all these people screaming in my head for not saying this. The CDC initially said, don't use masks. So there are just these very specific cases of mistaken expert-driven authority making incorrect or frankly not harms-based calls. How should we think about that? I'll throw it to you, Mehran, first, and then get you, Jeremy.
Yeah, I love your question because, you know, whenever I think about issues like that, I always go back to Galileo. So I like to go back to, you know, deep historical examples of an opinion that is not popular at the time that it is stated, but turns out to be right. How do you balance that versus what might otherwise be misinformation at the time? I think there's a couple ways to think about it. One is the power of platforms themselves being technology platforms means they actually have a lot of knobs that they can turn. So the question is not one of, do I put this information out there in an unconstrained way or do I not? But there's ways that I can make information available on a platform with particular constraints on it. I can limit its virality, how quickly it gets spread, how many times it's allowed to be replicated, until I can gather more information about the veracity or the falsification of that information. So we can use the technology itself to be able to help us without making a binary decision around free speech to think about how do we just slow down its virality so we can have the time to be able to deliberate more on it. The second is the issue of information changes over time. It gets updated. And so part of understanding the framework for guidelines around why information gets posted at a particular time and why it doesn't, why it gets taken down, allows for those same guidelines to explain over time why a piece of information may have been moderated at a particular point, but was not moderated later or vice versa. Because you can show at this point, more information was collected and we crossed the line. And that line is clear in the guidelines, right? And that gives everyone more confidence to the fact that these decisions aren't being made willy-nilly and also shows the ability for us to accumulate more knowledge over time to make better decisions.
The two things I'd add, and it's such a great question, and I think pushes on all the things that people are grappling with. The first thing I'd say is we've got to avoid falling into the trap of seeing things as either free speech, all no holds barred, leave it up to the companies, everything goes up, versus government censorship, right? This kind of boogeyman of the platforms don't get to make decisions anymore, and somehow we have to come to agreement on exactly what content can be promoted on these platforms, because that's a totally unhelpful binary. And you know what Mehran described in terms of the different knobs and levers, you know, in part, he's thinking about how we actually teach our students. So we build models for them to play with where they can think about the different levers and tools that are at their disposal in designing a newsfeed or a social media platform and see how revenue is affected by different choices, but also how you might upweight other values that you care about, like the health of our democracy or the health of our population. So avoid the binaries is point number one. And point number two is to recognize that this is going to be an iterative process. People are going to make choices, and those choices are going to be debated. Users are going to be dissatisfied. Government's going to be dissatisfied. Corporate leaders are going to be criticized. Politicians are going to be criticized. And for you who began the conversation saying, I'm really skeptical that democracy can do anything, that's actually what we need to have happen, right? That's how we are going to clarify our views collectively on what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable, is that we're going to go through this process of experimentation with the regulation of these powerful new technologies. And we're going to learn from that experience. And we're going to develop a much more collective understanding through deliberation and debate and experience of what we think is really beyond the line and what we think is acceptable.
I want to get into both of your definitions of A, what democracy is, but B, what questions are up to our political system to actually resolve? So there are some folks who would say, I'm thinking of a good, so for example, something we'll get into in a second is this issue of screen addiction and the nature of the way the tech platforms are actually designed. Senator Hawley put forth a bill that would regulate the way that Twitter was designed so that it wouldn't be run in a specific way that would increase time on app. So this is everything from infinite scroll to the color of the, I'm not a user design person, obviously, but there's certain color and UX user experience choices that Twitter has made to create engagement. But more libertarian minded people would basically say that that's just not a question which is up to the government to decide whether or not people are voting it on it or not. And they would say that this is a republic, free speech, First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's where a lot of the content moderation debates actually come into. So help me just understand what you all mean by democracy. Because another thing I was thinking about when you all were talking about Donald Trump is I definitely know a more conservative listener who's really concerned about Donald Trump and deplatforming would say, hey, respecting democracy as a value means you do not touch the Twitter account of the person who was elected president. So these things could mean so many different things depending on how you want to frame them ideologically. So I would just love definition of democracy and then B, like what questions are up for democratic control, whether it's who gets platformed or not, or the actual design of the apps themselves.
This is such an important issue to dig into. Let me start by saying it's really important when we think about what democracy is and isn't to array democracy, even our democracy, against alternatives. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we do in the book is we take on the notion that the regulation of tech or the governance of tech should really be the province of experts, right? Either experts that are designated by government or more likely, and what you often hear in Silicon Valley is just leave it to the corporate leaders. And we talk about the challenges of expert rule and why expert rule, in particular in environments in which people have a diversity of preferences and different views, have not been preferred forms of rule, right? That is, in essence, a form of oligarchy or authoritarianism. We can track the outcomes of those kinds of regimes in the past. And so over history, this country has arrived at our technology for making hard decisions, which is what we call democracy. And it's a process, of course, in our case, we elect officials to make these decisions as opposed to a form of direct democracy where we're all involved in making these decisions. And central to the definition of democracy is the fact that those elected officials are accountable to us as voters in a regular cycle so that if we are dissatisfied with their performance, we can replace them. And so the regular and routinized elections that are held credibly and give equal voice to everyone, of course, an effort that has been undertaken over time to ensure that there is equal voice, is at the core of democracy. And then people round out that definition with notions of things like a healthy public sphere where these issues can be debated and access to information and checks and balances in, you know, on the executive branch with the legislature and the judiciary. So thick and thin definitions, but at the core, the notion that those people who are making decisions are accountable to us as citizens of this political community and can be replaced on a regular, systematic cycle through elections. How do we think about what should enter the realm of politics? For us, it's all about externalities, right? Mm-hmm. So we introduce a perspective on externalities, you know, in the opening of the book, where we say, when you think about the behavior of a private sector company that pollutes the river, right? And ultimately that affects the drinking water of people downstream, all of us agree that, or many of us agree, most of us agree that that's an appropriate moment for government intervention. A profit maximizing company doing its production, but that has societal consequences, perhaps unintended, of the behaviors that they carry out. And so the book is built around four arenas in which those externalities are unavoidable and incredibly salient at the current moment, right? The first is about algorithmic decision-making and the role that hidden algorithms are playing in undermining the value that we attach to fairness, right? The second is about the monetization of people's personal data and the value that that undermines with respect to privacy, right? The third is about the returns that we get to artificial intelligence and automation and the value that that undermines with respect to our notions of ensuring that people can provide for themselves and experience well-being. And then the fourth is this tension between the value that we attach to free speech and the health of our democratic ecosystem, right? Our information ecosystem. So those are four areas where the externalities of technology are 100% clear. And it's not in the ability of a single individual to mitigate those societal externalities as a result of their choice. What's different about tech addiction, right? The example that you gave with the Hawley bill is that there are undoubtedly effects of using technology, but it is in the control of individuals 100% to remove themselves and their children, right, from the use of these technologies. And as users, there's a lot of power that comes from pressure on the platforms to provide all sorts of alternatives in terms of UX design or functionalities that enable people to avoid some of the more addictive features. That doesn't fit in the category of a societal externality that demands collective action.
And to add to that, what I'd say is, you know, sometimes what's overlooked in the online debates is that it's just treated very differently from, you know, debates about the physical world. And in reality, there's lots of limits, you know, even in a democracy, for example, that we place on freedom of speech. We don't just say it's a free for all that anyone can say whatever they want, right? The Supreme Court has defined the notion of imminent danger, for example, that puts boundaries on what people can say. So to the extent in what we consider a free society in a democracy, we still have guardrails for notions of what we think of with our freedoms, like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Those are kinds of things that we still need to think about in the online space as well. So if we want to regulate the online space, it doesn't mean that we're curtailing people's freedom in a greater sense. It means that what we're trying to do is find what are the appropriate frameworks in the same way we did in the physical world to apply to the online world. And in the online world, we actually have some more knobs and levers that we can turn with respect to understanding how we, for example, allow that speech to propagate. The other way I think about it is kind of a analogy to the online or from between the online and the physical world in thinking in terms of democracy, in terms of the definition of democracy. I'm more than happy to, you know, defer to what Jeremy said as an expert in this area, but is thinking about the notion of where are the places that we regulate now and how do we think about individual decision versus regulation? And I think a great example of that that we like to use a lot is thinking of the roadway system, right? We don't just say, you know what, it's a free-for-all and people should just drive safely. And if they don't drive safely, well, that's their own problem. What we do is we put in a whole bunch of regulations. We create lanes as to where people should drive. We create stoplights so that people have to stop and look around. We put in speed bumps to slow down around schools. We put in things into the system that create safety for everyone, that create a safer system that's not just about individual choice. That's the same analogy to the online space. The way we think about regulation is helping create a system that works for everyone, and then there's still individual choices within that system.
You two have both alluded to this at various points, so I'll just ask the question directly. What lessons can we take from how alternate political systems / governance models have approached this? So I'm referring obviously to the European Union and China through the CCP. What's interesting about both examples is that this could be a bit of a parody and an exaggeration, but the European situation from my perspective seems to be a bit different because they don't have the same type of technology industry that we do. It's also a European Union, so it's not quite a nation state the same way the US and China are. And then what's also interesting is for a long time, it seems that the Chinese were attempting to create their own very direct capitalistic competitor to Silicon Valley. But we're now seeing over the past few months, the CCP very directly cracking down on tech companies and forcing them through leadership changes, through even like, I don't want to say spanking because that really understates how like severe these things are, but by really seriously saying there are guardrails they're putting ones on. What lessons should we take from the Chinese and European examples when it comes to regulating these companies, both positive and negative?
So let me start with a comment on Europe, which is to say that, you know, we describe this in the book, and of course it's not always visible, just how powerful a player Europe has become in the regulatory landscape of tech. And it's an important reminder to people in the United States that while the US government and Congress may be dysfunctional and polarized and may not choose to act, it doesn't mean that other places in the world that are users of tech and where American-based tech companies have huge incentives to maintain market access and market dominance aren't themselves going to act. And what I'd say is sort of most in parallel between the US and Europe is that these are two environments in which the private sector is powerful. The private sector plays an incredibly important role as an engine of innovation, as an engine of job creation. And so when you think about how Europe has approached the regulation of tech, as the US will ultimately approach the regulation of tech, it is going to be some balancing of maintaining the powerful potential of the market, creating incentives for people to join these companies, allowing capital to flow freely to products that are going to be game changers for us in our professional and personal lives, while at the same time forging consensus around the potential externalities of tech, right, or the challenges posed by tech that need to be addressed through regulation. And I think you saw Europe show its first kind of leadership action on issues of privacy with the General Data Protection Regulation. And here's a case where privacy is more valued in Europe and has been historically than it has been in the United States, in part because of the exposure that many Europeans have had to strong central states that violated, you know, privacy and ultimately created norms around privacy protection that are a lot stronger than the norms in the United States. So you got leadership from Europe. And when you got leadership from Europe, creating new expectations around transparency or portability or meaningful consent is very hard then for the companies to design something that is specially designed for Europe and not to provide those same benefits to people in the United States and other markets. And of course, we saw California follow Europe fairly quickly with the California Consumer Privacy Act, replicating a lot of the dimensions of GDPR. In contrast with China, you don't have the same commitment to preserving the independent space of operation for the private sector, right? Nor do you have the mechanisms of citizen voice and pressure and accountability shaping the behavior of the Chinese government. And this is why you hear the concerns from folks, some in the national security space and some in the technology space, that say by providing space to govern technology democratically, we're basically guaranteeing that we're going to lose the war to China. Because ultimately, China is going to provide very strong incentives for companies to share personal data because they're going to amass powerful data engines from which they can learn using everyone's personal data. And I think my response to that is just to say, the externalities of technology are so visible to us today that some of the most fundamental things in our society are at risk: our democracy, our well-being. And we've got to get those in order to effectively compete with anyone on the world stage. And that's what the focus of this book is on.
The thing I'd add to that is thinking about the motivations involved, because I think, you know, privacy is a perfect example where if you were to contrast the European Union, the United States, and some of the recent regulations announced in China, the endpoints actually seem like they're going to be fairly similar. The motivations for reaching those endpoints are quite different. So if you look at the European Union, for example, you know, by taking the lead on GDPR, one of the things by taking the lead is they showed the strong commitment to privacy as a citizen's right. And so their motivation there was to enshrine a particular set of rights that users would have around their data, because they found that right to be extremely important vis-a-vis the control of the companies. If you look at the United States, that now we have CCPA, potentially there are some plans in the future to get federal regulation around this. And CCPA, you know, has some differences, but has some similarities.
Sorry, can you define CCPA?
Sorry, the California Consumer Protection Act, which was basically, or which is actually, a set of rights that individuals would have over their data. And it was, you know, pushed in California. There are some legislative history behind it, but basically because many of the big tech platforms are headquartered in California, and the feeling was that if they have to comply with this regulation in California, likely by default, they will just roll it out across all states. But the motivation there was a mitigation of harm, right? Because the United States traditionally has had this notice and choice framework where you put up your terms of service, you can either choose to use the service or not choose to use the service. And if you choose to use the service, you basically are swallowing whole the terms of service that the companies outline for you to have. And that's allowed by this notice and choice framework. But the United States saw that there is actually harms that are arising as a result of this. And so legislation like CCPA was a reaction to harms rather than thinking about the rights of citizens as the starting point. In China now, you're getting proposals for you're getting the regulation, right, that also has dimensions that are very similar to GDPR. But the motivation for that didn't seem to originally come from citizens' rights or mitigating harms. The motivation for that came from limiting the power of tech platforms vis-a-vis the government of China, right? And so you get to places that maybe there's some consensus on what should be done, which is actually an interesting thing to think about these different regimes having different motivations, but actually getting to an endpoint that's somewhat similar actually gives you hope to say, maybe there are legislative endpoints that actually make sense, but the motivation to actually get there can be quite different.
Something I'm wondering about as we're nearing the end here is, help me and the audience understand a little more about where we are in terms of the tech industry's history and the way that American culture and society are evolving. So I'm just pretty, not just doing devil's advocate here, I actually believe this to my ticks. I'm pretty strongly convinced that we should think of Facebook and a lot of the current tech platforms the way we thought of Microsoft after 2000, in the sense that there are all these very specific harms, really bad behaviors, and those harms and bad behaviors needed some form of check. And that check didn't have to involve the antitrust case against Microsoft being one. What was just key to have happen was, A, the company was hobbled in a very serious way that it took it over a decade to recover. And then at the same time, they also were having to think, hey, let's not overstep our bounds. I think we've gotten there with Facebook. Obviously, the conversation around Clubhouse is very different than it was when the app was really hot, but it was very clear in the discourse 5 or 6 months ago that it was off the table to imagine a world where Facebook was going to be able to buy Clubhouse after US regulators and politicians lamented the world where Facebook was able to buy Instagram. So push back against my view that we are just largely and incompletely, right? I'm not saying it was a good thing that the US government couldn't complete its antitrust case in 2000. But the part of me that's ironically kind of optimistic is I think the necessary steps have happened to change these behaviors and these really bad events that happened from 2013 to 2018, 2019, even 2021. So what would be the pushback against that from your perspective? Either of you could take that.
Well, maybe to start, to think about the notion of, you know, greater scrutiny for one thing, right? So I actually do agree with the notion that even if the antitrust action, for example, doesn't have a substantive result in terms of breaking up a company into smaller pieces, just the greater scrutiny that comes with looking at activity that they're engaged in, greater criticality for potential acquisitions and mergers in the future, changes the landscape of operation. Right. And that's, I think, the most significant consequence that came out of the Microsoft antitrust case. It wasn't the consent decree. Clearly, the company wasn't broken up, but it created a landscape in which we actually got more competition. And one could argue better technological outcomes or product outcomes for consumers overall. And so I think that's part of what's related now to thinking about different platforms is if we can have greater scrutiny that causes them internally to have to apply greater scrutiny to their own processes. Nicole Wong, who's a former CTO of the United States and was a guest in one of our class lectures, also talked about this notion of a slow food movement in technology, that rather than always just trying to race to get something out there and then see what the consequences are. If there's more time for the deliberation of understanding what the consequences of that technology may be to try to mitigate the harms before you release it. And if there's greater scrutiny in the tech sector, whether it comes from antitrust or other sources of regulation, I think what we'll see is a little bit more of that deliberative decision-making and greater internal scrutiny before these products are released. And that, I think, has a lot of potential to lead to better outcomes.
What I'd add, Marshall, is just to say that you might be right, and you might be right with respect to some of the harms that are most visible to us now. But unless we attack the core ingredients that has given us a dominant and concentrated tech sector that generates new products and scales them with significant negative externalities on society, we don't know what the next set of harms are going to be, what the next technology is going to be. And so feeling comfortable that somehow the shot across the bow or, you know, the knuckle to the chin of Facebook has sort of reared, you know, in the problem, reined in the problem, I think would be sort of far too conservative and optimistic an assessment of where we are at the current moment. That ultimately, this is going to be an iterative game. It's going to play out over generations. It's not going to play out over one Congress and its legislative cycle. And as we've seen, you know, in repeated sort of histories of the kind of race between disruptive technologies and democracy, you know, there's iteration to this game, right? And right now we're in a position to see some visible harms and to issue warnings and to, you know, launch investigations and you know, create cases in court. But we don't know what's coming next. And the pace at which things are coming next is profound, right? And ultimately, we're going to need to build a set of institutions, both in the private sector and in the public sector, that are better able to quickly identify those harms and address them, rather than waiting to a moment that we're in like now, where our information ecosystem is polluted, large numbers of low-wage workers are out of jobs and concerned about the future of their jobs, and sort of fundamental notions of privacy and fairness are deeply at risk because of the power that we've handed over to a small number of large platforms.
I just want to almost close here by actually just completely agreeing with everything you all just said. And you've actually corrected my framework in a useful way, because what I'm realizing is a couple of things. So number one, to your point, Jeremy, the big debate we're actually having as a society right now is, what is a monopoly? Does the Burkean standard still apply? How different is the internet from a traditional industry when we're looking at policies that came up during the progressive era? So the problem for me just saying, hey, like, this is all Microsoft, everything's fine, is that the Microsoft case may have handled Internet Explorer and Netscape's beef there, but it didn't actually solve the actual problem we had, which is that we're debating the nature of monopoly in the 21st century. So that's actually a very useful addendum that, like, I somewhat stupidly didn't really think about now, which is that if we're actually looking at the systemic issue, it's that we actually have to democratically come to a consensus on what monopoly is. And if we're looking at the Sherman Antitrust Act, that is an example of, during a previous era in a different industry, people doing the process that you're describing here. So that's a really important thing to note. And then number two, the other mistake in the framework I'm bringing here, and sorry that I'm giving you this background, but the audience has heard me bring up this example every time we do a tech episode, so it's important that I own up for my mistakes here. I'm also realizing that it's not quite accurate to compare post.com bubble 2001 America to the America that we're living in today. That's kind of the whole point of this show, The Realignment, but that's the whole point of your book, which is that, you know, an era where the web is coming back after the dot-com crash, and you do just have these, you know, Google hasn't even IPO'd at the point that I'm really describing. So it's an entirely different world. So it's not particularly useful to bring up at a perfect metaphorical level, an example from that time, when the whole conceit here of this discussion is that there are things like artificial intelligence. There are these broader, more systemic changes than just search engines and just basic social networks like Friendster and MySpace that are really there. So in all seriousness, I really like to think out loud as we're doing this. So I appreciate everything the two of you have said. So just to wrap this up with the final question for you both, whoever wants to take a go first, what, aside from purchasing the book, what should folks do next? We have a diverse audience here. We have people who see me on the street and say we should bring Ben Thompson on, aka they're a very specific tech part of New York. We also have people who are conservative, people who are liberal, people who are in these different groups of citizens, politicians, users, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How should these different groups think of their next steps, once again, beyond just purchasing the really great book?
You know, I think, first of all, the important thing, you know, there's the book itself. The book is one means for people to inform themselves. That's probably the biggest first step right now is for PN, as people are listening to this podcast, for example, is to inform yourself about what are the issues that are involved and find clarity for yourself as to where you stand on those issues. There's definitely value trade-offs involved, and what you want to clarify for yourself is, where do I stand on those value trade-offs? What do I want to advocate for? Otherwise, you give that decision up to someone else. There are, of course, people always ask, you know, what can I do at a personal level, right, in my engagement with technology? And there are things that people can do, you know, things like setting the privacy settings in your applications, using incognito mode for searches, choosing, you know, at some level what applications you decide you want to use and which ones you don't want to engage in, setting your cookie preferences, which now you have to do anyway, thanks to GDPR. But those are the individual actions that you can take as a first step, right, to safeguard your privacy or think about where the source of information you want to get. But the larger issue to realize is that all of us play a role in this process. And unless we inform ourselves and are willing to take a stand for those things, to push in the political process for particular outcomes, if we're a technologist to understand the role we play in actually building these technologies and the choices we make even at the low level of code, if we're an executive in terms of what are the things that we try to push our companies to do or the products that we release, everyone plays a role. And that's really the message, you know, I would leave you with.
And the final words that I'd give you on your question, Marshall, are that, you know, for us, we come to this work as educators. You know, we've been teaching material, you know, to Stanford undergraduates who are headed towards careers in technology. And ultimately, we see that there's not only a short game, which is part of what we talked about in Washington, but there's a long game about preparing our democracy, you know, to better govern technology for the future. And so for us, that means that the work that we've done with this book is not where the work ends. So over the course of the next year, we're going to be working with students at more than 100 colleges and universities around the United States to curate special and focused discussions on the intersection of tech and ethics, to go deep on these issues with voices who are at the leading frontier, not only in academia, but also in companies themselves or in advocacy groups. We're teaching courses in the evening for professional technologists, giving them an opportunity outside of the contours of their company. So if you're interested in those kinds of engagements, get in touch with us. And ultimately, we're going to be spending a lot of this fall and next spring working directly with companies and funders to think about how they embed serious consideration and deliberation around ethical trade-offs in their processes of product design and as they make investment decisions. Because as we said at the outset, yes, we need a role for government, but no, government cannot address these challenges on its own. And that ultimately creating a healthy environment for the growth of tech and the realization of its benefits, but also the mitigation of potential harms, is really the work of all of us.
Really well said. Jeremy Mayron, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment. Good luck with the book launch. I'm sure you, and it's very clear you put a lot of work into this, so congratulations.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Marshall.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.